of the course. And I also put a couple of chapters of the book Bureaucracy by von Mises on there. Let's see, let me read the chat for a second. Looks like, is anybody having trouble with the audio? Von Mises was really the first modern economist to write in a systematic way about the economics of bureaucracy. There's a very big literature in this, in the sub-discipline of economics known as public choice. And in the first book, I guess, on the topic from a public choice perspective was by William Niskanen. The title escapes me now. It's an old book, I think 1972 or something like that. And I think it's Bureaucracy and the Democratic Process or something like that. But if you look up William Niskanen, you'll find his book on bureaucracy. And it's very mainstream, very Chicago school. Niskanen was a Chicago school economist. And it's a bit different than the von Mises book. But von Mises wrote his book in the 1940s. So he really was the first modern economist to seriously study bureaucracy. And much of what Rothbard says from a theoretical perspective in his writing that I put on the syllabus tonight comes from the Mises book. And it's a bit of an elaboration of the Mises book, but the basic ideas are from Mises and other Austrians too, of course. And then Rothbard, in his vintage way, adds a great deal of historical perspective to the theory, the economic theory provided by Mises in the book. Okay, so well, let me get started on some of the substance. I just want to give a little perspective on why this is worthwhile pursuing. It's kind of interesting how Rothbard laid out the historical perspective, as Mises does, on how it came to be that we have these large bureaucracies that are associated with governments. And the history of it is apparently that when the monarchs of Europe began ruling over larger and larger domains, the big problem facing them was how to keep control, how to delegate power. If on a small domain, it would be the king and his court and a small army, but when they ruled over thousands and thousands of miles of property, how do you delegate power in a way that you can keep your own power? And the original solution was to give out parcels of land to princes, to what I think Mises calls petty princes, I guess. But the princes warred with each other, and they sometimes warred against the king and tried to overthrow the king. And so that wasn't very good from the king's perspective. And after that came along the idea of government, permanent government bureaucrats to administer things for the king, as opposed to the system of petty princes, as he said. And so and that's an interesting perspective on why it is we have the system we do, where governments are run by vast bureaucracies. And there's an excellent quote on page 17 about the essence of bureaucracy and what bureaucracy is for, what it is about. In page 17 of the book Bureaucracy by Ludwig von Mises, that is, and where he says this: totalitarianism is much more than mere bureaucracy. It is the subordination of every individual's whole life, work, and leisure to the orders of those in power and office. It is the reduction of man to a cog in an all-embracing machine of compulsion and coercion. It forces the individual to renounce any activity of which the government does not approve. It tolerates no expression of dissent. It is the transformation of society into a strictly disciplined labor army, as the advocates of socialism say, or into a penitentiary, as its opponents say. And skipping down to the next paragraph, Mises says, bureaucracy is instrumental in the execution of these plans. And so I'm not saying that, say, modern America, for example, is necessarily a totalitarian society, but it certainly has been moving in that direction. And if you look at all the bureaucracy that we do have, federal, state, and local level of government, it pretty much fits into this idea of totalitarian control of everyone's lives. We don't have the mass murder of dissenters like we did in the old Soviet Union, but we have petty tyrants everywhere. In fact, one of the books that I wrote, co-authored with James Bennett some years ago, was titled The Food and Drink Police, and the subtitle was America's, Petty Dictators and Tyrants, I think, was in the subtitle. It was about 15 years ago or so, James Bennett and I wrote that book about the Food and Drink Police. And we argued that they were planning on doing to food and liquor what they did with tobacco, and hound people to death until they can impose heavier taxes on these things, and then earmark the money for the activists themselves to go off on another crusade to keep us from consuming salt or large Slurpees at Starbucks or whatever. But anyway, if you look at the federal bureaucracy, the state bureaucracies, and local government bureaucracies, it pretty much fits into what von Mises says here about totalitarianism. And in my view, and also in Rothbard's view, just about all politicians, with very rare exceptions like Ron Paul, really are totalitarians at heart, which is why they get into politics. They get into politics because they wanted to use the coercive powers of government to force people to behave in ways that they want them to behave, not the ways that other people want to behave. And that's essentially why so many people get into politics. Now, in modern society, in a country like the U.S., we have several hundred years of bureaucracy built up. And so whoever happens to get elected to any office, governor, state legislator, member of Congress, they get to hold on to the reins of power that have been accumulating for several hundred years. And so, 200 years ago, or even 150 years ago, it wasn't such a bad thing if you had dangerous or stupid or even evil people in the government. They couldn't do that much damage to you 150 years ago, at least in the U.S. But today they really can. Today the pettiest moron can do a great deal of damage and ruin your life because he latches on to so many powers and controls that have been accumulated over the centuries that he can be very dangerous, just anybody. And that's what Mises is talking about. Bureaucracy is instrumental in the execution of these plans. These plans control your life. Another thing he says is this, and I'm quoting, "The struggle against bureaucracy is essentially a revolt against totalitarian dictatorship." And I think what I would add to this, this language of totalitarian dictatorship, is to remind the class that in his famous essay, The Law, Friedrich Bastiat pointed out that under democracy, you can get the same result as under communism if under democracy you get a law that forces uniformity among the population of some sort of social plan. It doesn't have to be dictatorship that imposes totalitarian rule. It could be the god of democracy, as is called by Hans Hoppe and others, that uses the coercive powers of government to enforce the uniformity of some sort of social plan, whether it's socialized medicine or socialized anything else. It's essentially a totalitarian system. And where people really get confused over bureaucracy, you know, everybody complains about bureaucracy. Mises starts his book by talking about this, but, you know, no one likes bureaucracy. No one wants to be called a bureaucrat. Even if you are a government bureaucrat, you don't want to be called a government bureaucrat because it's considered to be an insult to most people to be called a bureaucrat. But there are very fundamental differences between how resources get allocated by government bureaucrats and by private competitive businesses under the profit and loss system. And there's a great quote on page 20 of Bureaucracy by von Mises, and it really is a paraphrase of the same thing he says in his book Human Action. And here's what he says about the market. He's talking about the market and profit management as opposed to bureaucratic management. So he systematically compares the profit and loss system to a government bureaucracy system. as the real bosses in a capitalist system of the market economy are consumers. They, by their buying and by their abstention from buying, decide who should own the capital and run the plants. They determine what should be produced and in what quantity and quality. Their attitudes result either in profit or loss for the enterprisemen. They make poor men rich and rich men poor. They are no easy bosses. They are full of whims and fancies, changeable and unpredictable. They do not care a whit for past merit. As soon as something is offered to them that they like better or is cheaper, they desert their own old purveyors. With them, nothing counts more than their own satisfaction. They bother neither about the vested interests of capitalists nor about the fate of the workers who lose their jobs if, as consumers, they no longer buy what they used to buy. And that's an important point about understanding the economy, in that even though we witness, in a market economy anyway, we witness certain people who run the banks and who run the capital markets or who make big decisions on Wall Street and so forth, they're ultimately guided by consumers, because if they can't sell the product, they're out of business. And so the point Macy's made is that in a capitalistic system, that it's really the consumer who is in charge. And so consumer sovereignty reigns, in other words. The consumer is king. And another way in which he explains this, he says, the capitalist system of production is an economic democracy in which every penny gives a right to vote. So compared to spending your pennies to votes. Okay. And of course, the profit and loss system is the essence of the capitalist system. That if you do a good job in serving your customers, you'll make money, you'll thrive, and you'll draw investors in. If you do a poor job at keeping the customers happy, then you lose money, you may go bankrupt, and you'd be pretty miserable. And so the market feedback mechanism is all important in the market, but it's non-existent in government. There is no market feedback mechanism in government. And so, and that, of course, is a very important difference. And then Mises also gets into his famous economic calculation argument in explaining the big difference between profit management and government bureaucratic management. And for example, well, the essence of the calculation problem argument is that in a capitalist economy, the first prerequisite is private property. We have to have private property because that's what is traded. That's what is bought and sold is property rights. Rights to own property, rights to use property, and to sell property. That's what property rights are. And so once we have established a system of reasonably well-defined and protected property rights, we can have markets. Markets will work. If we don't have reasonably well-defined property rights, markets don't work so well. If you think that your property can be taken away from you or stolen or confiscated by the government, you will behave very differently than if you were assured that your property will be protected with legal contracts and so forth. And so once we have that, can have markets. And once we have markets, we can have market prices. And with market prices, we have prices that reflect relative scarcity. They reflect changing consumer demands. And so when entrepreneurs look at market prices, they give them very important information about the relative scarcities of items and about how to go about calculating profit and loss, because the inputs into any production process are a matter of all the factors of production priced at the market price. And so when an entrepreneur purchases all those inputs, land, labor, capital, and so forth, what the bottom line is that he has to take all of these factors of production and combine them in a way that produces products that people will pay more for than the value of the factors of production in and of themselves before the entrepreneur did his thing, in other words. And so, and that's what profit is. Profit is what's left over after all the factors of production are paid for. And so the profit system, a profit in accounting sense, tells us whether or not we are actually adding value to the economy or destroying value to the economy. And that's the only way human civilization has ever devised of determining that question, of answering that question. Are we adding to value or destroying value? Are we getting $1,000 worth of resources and turning them into more than $1,000 worth of products? If so, we're adding value and we're being rewarded for it with profits. Or are we getting $1,000 worth of resources and turning them into $100 worth of something, or zero, or things that nobody will pay a penny for? If so, we're destroying value in the economy. And that, of course, is what socialism did year in and year out, year in and year out. And so with regard to bureaucracy, under profit management, this is the system. And Mises tells this whole story about the economic calculation problem to make the main point here about bureaucracy, that this simply does not exist in government bureaucracy. There are no profits and losses in an accounting sense. There are only budgets in government. And so so economic calculation under a governmental system and government is literally impossible, because there are no profits to be measured, or losses to be measured. Okay, and so instead of that, what we have is rules and budgets. And Mises says, under bureaucratic management, what we have is rules and budgets and the will of the supreme authority. Now, the pettiest local government bureaucrat considers himself to be the supreme authority, doesn't he? And so he's not referring only to the supreme dictator, you know, Mao Zedong or Adolf Hitler or somebody like that. He's talking about bureaucrats of all sorts who consider themselves the supreme authority in whatever little area they are regulating. And so there's no profit and loss system, and that means there's just pure chaos in a government bureaucratic system. And of course, an important point that is made here by Mises and also by Rothbard in his writings is about the myth of business-like government. All of you have probably heard, or at some point, some politician claiming that they're going to improve the efficiency of the government and by running it like a business, and they will sometimes get a retired chief executive officer or even an active chief executive officer of a corporation to retire temporarily to become the director of some government agency to try to make people think that somehow that government agency is going to be run like a business and be efficient. And they'll use language like, we'll cut out the waste and the fraud and so forth, and we'll streamline it. But of course, that's always impossible, because there are no profit and loss statements in an accounting sense in government. And also, no real business has all of its capital and most or all of its labor costs paid for by somebody else, by the taxpayers. And so just for that reason alone, the idea that government can be business-like is a farce. If those of you who have ever heard of the phrase Potemkin Village, P-O-T-E-M-K-I-N, Potemkin was a KGB officer in the Soviet Union who was in charge of creating false villages, phony villages for Western visitors who would come, journalists and other people would go to the Soviet Union, and they would have fake cities set up where everyone is clean and healthy and smiling and happy. And then these Westerners would go back home and write articles in their newspapers and magazines about how wonderful life was under communism. Well, that's what a version of that is done by governments under democracy whenever they try to tell the public that they are going to hire a CEO or set up a board of directors, just like in the corporate world of a government organization. They're trying to create a sort of a Potemkin Village effect for some government bureaucracy to lull the public into thinking that they are not squandering their money. But of course they are, because there's nothing else they could possibly be doing. Another difference between government bureaucracies and private competitive business firms is that the main way to advance in business is to participate, usually to participate in a team that produces a valued good and service that is valued by consumers that results in profits. And the more profitable your team is, the more likely you will get a pay raise and a bonus and a promotion. If you're a proprietor, you'll become wealthier and so forth. So that's the way to advance your career in the private sector, to demonstrate that you can be an important part of a team that creates value. Or you can be an individual who creates value by inventing products or services or ways of doing business that people do in fact value. In government, since there are no profits and losses, there are no profits that can be taken home by government managers, what has become, and has become for a long, long time, the standard for promotion, how you get promoted to a bigger and better job, a better paying job in government bureaucracies, is by having more subordinates working under you. The first question that is usually asked if somebody is applying for a government job is, well, how many people worked for you under you in your last job? And because they want to know, you know, are you able to manage this bigger bureaucracy without creating too much turmoil, I suppose. And so that creates a built-in incentive to do what? To hire as many people as humanly possible, even if it greatly exceeds the number of people who are necessary to perform whatever task it is you're performing. And now, of course, there are empire builders in the private sector, but there's always the bottom line. If there are empire builders in the private sector, they do periodically get weeded out because the stock price will drop. Corporate takeovers can be a way in which corporations are punished for being excessively costly because of bureaucratic empire building and other reasons. And so there are market penalties for empire building. This doesn't mean there will never be any empire builders in the corporate world, because there are, but it's a very costly endeavor. And of course, in an area where managers compete with one another, the competition can go in the other direction. Whoever can get the job done with the minimum cost and the minimum of bureaucracy, that's who's going to get promoted by a real capitalist enterprise, not somebody who surrounds himself with yes men and yes women just for his own aggrandizement. And so the dynamic works can work quite the opposite direction in the private sector than in the government sector. And so to a very large extent, what goes on in government bureaucracies is cost maximization. In businesses, it's cost minimization, because the lower the cost, the higher the profit, and the higher the profit, the more money the managers make, and the more money everybody associated with the enterprise is likely to make. And so cost minimization is the key. That's why, for example, when Coca-Cola figured out how to drastically reduce the amount of aluminum that it uses in Coca-Cola cans, it was not motivated by environmentalism. They did not join the Sierra Club and decide that they wanted to use less aluminum and so that they would mine less bauxite in the world. They were totally motivated by the desire to cut the cost of shipping Coca-Cola around the world, which would therefore increase their profits. And so the profit motive is a very, very strong motive in terms of conservation of resources, because conservation of resources is just another way of saying cost minimization, which is the flip side of profit maximization. But in government, cost maximization is more likely to be the objective, because the more people you hire, the more people you have working around you, the more costly it is, the more likely you will be promoted and to a bigger and better job and a better paying job. And so you have an incentive to maximize costs. Also, in governments, it's almost impossible to fire anyone without a long drawn out lawsuit, or at the very least having to deal with the so-called civil service bureaucracy and their rules and their laws about the proper procedures. And so it's not untypical that in a federal government in the U.S., for example, if somebody wants to fire a government employee, they could be bound up in court for years, where the government unions will defend the employee to the death sometimes, and just it'll be drawn out for years. And so government managers who actually do want to get rid of people who they think are grossly incompetent, what they're likely to do instead is to give them a promotion rather than go through the all the stress and the turmoil of having to deal with a lawsuit against you. They will just give the person a promotion and a pay raise, and so use the carrot method rather than the stick method, rather than the stick of firing somebody who's incompetent. Dangle a big fat carrot in front of their head and arrange for them to get a pay raise and a promotion to get them out of your hair. That's why, for example, in the big cities in America, the central school bureaucracies are depositories typically of hundreds of teachers who cannot teach, who during their careers were sort of transferred around from school to school, and then the parents would complain bitterly that the math teacher can't count or something along those lines. And then after a while, they will just decide the reason they just, you can't fire these people because they have tenure and there are civil service regulations against it, but you can give them a high-paying job, maybe double the salary or more, at the central administrative office and give them some sort of job title that makes it sound like they're actually administering the entire school system. And so all of these central school bureaucracies are sort of dumping grounds or graveyards of the grossest, the most grossly incompetent teachers who then run the whole system eventually. So they apply their gross incompetence to bureaucracy, although some of them can be pretty good at bureaucracy and bureaucratic game playing. And so civil service rules prevent the firing of incompetence to a very large extent in government, whereas they don't in the private sector. And the essence of the difference, of course, is that the consumer ultimately is in control of the private sector, but in the government sector, what we have is the whims of politicians and bureaucrats. Many of the things government does, the so-called services that are provided, you have to keep in mind, there really is no way of knowing in government whether there really is a demand for these so-called services as there is in the market. In the market, entrepreneurs who perceive a product or a service that will be profitable, they perceive it that way because they understand that the consumers will actually like this enough to pay for it. Whereas in government, the government just announces these things. They don't even take surveys. They just say, well, we're going to do this. Or they take over. They're imperialists who will take over fire protection or the schools or police protection, as they have done historically. And they will run it as government bureaucracies and run it much less efficiently than these things were run when they were run by private competitive businesses. And so those are some of the key differences between government bureaucracies and the private sector. So in other words, when we get angry with bureaucracy and people complain about bureaucracy, it's not because government bureaucrats are necessarily more evil or stupid or selfish than anybody else. It's the system. It's the system of incentives that is vastly different in government bureaucracies. And you can get the same person, you can get the successful business person who was maybe a sole proprietor who created his or her own business and succeeded, became wealthy, put them in the government, and they will be just as incompetent and sloppy and inefficient as anybody else because of the incentive system in government. And so that's what von Mises had to say in a nutshell. That's a summary of the main ideas, I think, of the differences between profit management and government bureaucracy. Now, as far as Rothbard's commentary, he mentions at the very beginning of this reading that I put on the syllabus what I used to refer to as the octopus theory of information loss. That's a mouthful, the octopus theory of information loss. And what he's talking about is that in any hierarchical organization, any organization that has a hierarchy, upper management, middle management, lower management, you know, corporations have that, governments have that. Okay, there's usually information gathering at the bottom, information about what the consumers want, how to market things, local economic conditions, who the best suppliers are, who the cheapest suppliers are, all this sort of localized information of time and place that every business must rely on. That information has to filter up through middle management and then ultimately to top management, who makes the big decisions about the product line and pricing and so forth. So there's a hierarchy, and then there's a filtering from bottom to top of information that is used in the organizing of production. Now, in the competitive private sector, you could have people who only tell the boss the good news. They only want to filter up the good news. But if they only do that, that will lead to lower profits and possibly bankruptcy. It won't succeed in the long run in business. In government, it will succeed because government is forever. Government bureaucracies almost never die out. And so you can get away with being the government bureaucrat who never tells the bad news or the negative news to his uppers. Let the other sucker do it, as Rothbard said. Let the other sucker do it and lose his promotion. I'm not going to do it. And so you tend to get only selective information filtered up to the top that the boss wants to hear. And also, it's just the nature of any bureaucracy that is dealing with a large amount of information like this, that a lot of it is lost or distorted. And so the bigger the bureaucracy, the more likely it is that this information, much of it will be lost or distorted. And of course, the profit motive gives much more powerful incentives to minimize the loss and distortion of information than government does, because there is no profit motive in government. And so Rothbard talks about this, and it's essentially what he's talking about. I call it the octopus theory because I used to draw on the blackboard in my classes a hierarchy with the upper management at the top and then different arms coming out of middle management and accounting and finance and marketing, and then other arms and legs coming out with the lower management, and it looked kind of like an octopus. And to illustrate the information flow from bottom to top in a bureaucracy. And so that's one of the things that Rothbard adds that Mises doesn't really dwell on in his thought. And of course, Rothbard, you know, in his article, in his reading for tonight's class, typical Rothbard, he gives dozens of pages of actual history of bureaucracy in America. It's a pretty darn good overview or history of the development of government bureaucracy in America. And he starts with the founders and pointing out how there have been in history some libertarian-oriented statesmen or politicians, whatever you would want to call them, who understood these inherent problems in government bureaucracy and tried to at least limit them or minimize them in some ways. They were never so naive as to think we could have government and have no bureaucracy at all, but they tried to limit them. How do they try to do that? Well, with a written constitution, Rothbard points that out, with the separation of powers, by giving some powers to the judicial branch, some to the executive, some to the congressional branch, and also the Bill of Rights, or Bills of Rights. Each state in the U.S. has a Bill of Rights, and then there's a federal Bill of Rights, which essentially say, there are certain things where we are not going to use government bureaucracy. That is, for example, the First Amendment that guarantees the right of free speech says we are not going to use politics to decide who gets to speak and who doesn't get to speak on political matters in America. And so there is no bureaucracy regulating speech, although there is at American universities these days. Most American universities have turned into little totalitarian fiefdoms where they tend to in subtle and not so subtle ways regulate speech. Many of you are familiar with political correctness. And then Rothbard makes a big deal of how the early Americans were big advocates of term limits. The idea was that members of Congress, for example, would only serve maybe one or two terms, two-year terms, and then go back to being a farmer or a merchant or whatever they were doing before they entered politics. That was the original idea, and of course the virtue of that is that if you do go to the legislature and participate in the passing of laws, you would know that in the not-too-distant future, you're going to be out there having to be abiding by these same laws for the rest of your life. And so the idea was people would be a little more careful about the kind of laws they pass and the volume of laws that they pass controlling behavior, because they would have to live under them themselves. But of course, that is very different today, where in the U.S. Congress, for example, over 90% of all incumbents have been reelected on average for the past 50 years. And so they pretty much have isolated themselves from the rest of the population. And of course, John C. Calhoun would not have been surprised by that in any way whatsoever. In some of Rothbard's other writings, of course, he mentions secession and nullification as other things that the founding generation in America considered, other ways that they considered to try to control the expansion of bureaucracy. And Rothbard was an anarcho-capitalist, and so he's not saying that he's necessarily a fan of the idea that a written constitution could succeed. He's simply writing about history here. And it did succeed, by the way, for a while. People, as long as there was an ideological remnant in the country that could persuade enough people that strict constructionism, that is, strict enforcement of the United States Constitution's limits on government, was a good idea, it was reasonably effective for a generation or two. And so it took a long time for it to become destroyed, as it is now, as a limit on government. But it wasn't always that way. So this is a history lesson that Rothbard is talking about. Another point that's relevant here, and Rothbard makes a big deal of this, is that there is a link between the number of government bureaucrats, whether they are political appointees or not, and votes. And the way to look at it, I think, is that every government employee is probably worth at least two or three votes to the politician who helped arrange for his or her job. Because every government employee might have a spouse or a voting age child or a relative or a brother, sister, who will join with him in thanking the politician for giving him or her the job. And so it's worth a couple of votes. That's what the patronage system is. In the United States, many of you know that I've written several books on Lincoln and the political economy of the American Civil War. And Abraham Lincoln was known as the king of patronage in his day. The Republican Party really exploded the patronage system during the Lincoln administration, not just because of the war, that the country was at war, but that was always the plan of the so-called nationalists in American politics, was to solidify or monopolize political power with a vast system of political appointees or so-called patronage jobs, because they understood all along that each job was worth several votes, not just one necessarily, but several votes, and also campaign contributions, money. And so that's something that is a very big difference between the private competitive business world and government bureaucracies. And that's another reason why virtually everything government does, whenever there's a study comparing the government provision of anything, garbage collection to the running of airports to zoo maintenance, that there's always more labor-intensive provision of the service by government, because the motivation to hire people is not to minimize cost and maximize profit. It's to maximize the number of subordinates who work for you, because not only does it enhance your ability to get a bigger paying job or to be elected to a bigger office from mayor to governor, but it creates votes for you to do that. And so, the incentive is just the opposite. The incentive is to maximize the number of people you use to perform a task, not to minimize. And then, of course, there's the curse of essential or effective tenure because of civil service regulations. And Rothbard, in the article I put on the reading list, he gives a whole history of the whole so-called civil service reform. And he talks about the virtues of the old spoils system. So he compares the system whereby every time, say, at the federal level, say the Republican Party's candidate for president wins, they come in, they fire all the Democrats who have been political appointees. And then the Democrats do the same thing. When their candidate wins the presidency, they come in and fire all the Republicans and bring in new blood. That system changed in that what both parties do now is hundreds or thousands of people will come into the government as political appointees, and one of the first things they will do is fill out applications for permanent federal employment, to be a bureaucrat, not a political appointee. And of course, the people who are deciding whether or not you should be hired are the political appointees of your party. And so what we do is we fill up the bureaucracy with thousands or hundreds of thousands of permanent government employees who are protected by civil service regulations. And what that means is that you have to understand that every government bureaucrat is an empire builder. Every government bureaucrat is a relentless propagandist for his agency, for a bigger budget, more money, more resources, more people to be hired for his agency. And so you have people who become very skilled at politics, at the whole business of lying and conniving and manipulating and backstabbing, and they're at it for years, for decades, and they get very, very good at it. And so so one of the virtues of the spoil system, in Rothbard's view, is that all these people are flushed out every couple of years. It makes it much more difficult for them to have a 30 or 40 year career as a bureaucratic manipulator, manipulating the system for what? Not for the benefit of consumers, but for the benefit of forcing up higher taxes to hire more bureaucrats and to pay them higher salaries. That's why. That's what they get very, very good at. And it also pulling the wool over the public's eyes in what it is that they're doing with the taxpayers' money. They can become very, very good at that. There's a learning curve, in other words. And so when Rothbard tells this big, long story in this article of where this system came from, and he does say some flattering things in favor of the spoils system, that's what the spoils system was, just a system to the victor goes the spoils, and the spoils being patronage jobs. There was a virtue to it, and it flushed out the bureaucracy every couple of years so that people could not accumulate quite so much human capital and bureaucratic manipulation. Okay, and so my old professor, James Buchanan, from graduate school, once said that anyone who understands the economics of bureaucracy could not possibly be a socialist. And he said that before the worldwide collapse of socialism, but that was his opinion. You might have a lot of socialists who understand this, but even the Soviets hated bureaucracy. Bureaucrats hate bureaucracy, but there's nothing they can do about it. And so it's important to understand these things of why government bureaucracies are inherently inefficient. It's not just that there's too many people or that they're lazy or anything like that. It's inherent that they just don't work for us, for the consumers. They work for the bureaucrats very nicely, as a lot of you know. And so, but if you're seriously studying social policy, economics, then Buchanan was right. It'd be very hard to be a socialist if you understand the inherent economic incentives that exist in government bureaucracies and how vastly different they are from the private sector. So that's why I thought I'd put these readings for this week on government bureaucracy, because Rothbard was one of the few Austrians, him and Mises, who actually wrote about this in a systematic way. And the same is true of public finance, by the way. There are relatively few Austrians who wrote that much, who published that much about public finance, the economics of government spending and taxing. And the Rothbard was one of them. And even Mises didn't write that much on the subject. And so, and that'll be the next couple of weeks of classes. But I have about 7:15. That's my usual routine here, is 45 minutes of discussion. And then I'll be glad to do the Q&A again and see if anybody has some cues. So let me see if you have any questions, feel free. I don't see any questions yet. Okay. There's one question from Linus about, this is a good question, even in private organizations or social clubs, there's an incentive to have subordinates that, or to take control over the direction of the organization through the formation of committees, subcommittees, et cetera. In what ways can this be discouraged? Well, it can be discouraged, but it has to be discouraged by a leader of the committee. There's actually, this is one of the things that Peter Klein teaches. If you take Peter Klein's course, if he teaches the online course on hierarchies and organizations, this is his expertise. And Friedrich Hayek wrote a lot about it, much more than Rothbard. But and there's actually a textbook that I used to use and Peter Klein used to use on addresses issues like this. It's called Managerial Economics and Organizational Architecture. It's a kind of a clunky title for a textbook. It has several authors, but the first one that used to be listed was Zimmerman. And so Managerial Economics and Organizational Architecture, about half the book is applications of Hayekian economics, of Hayek's analysis of knowledge problems in economics, and it deals a lot with questions like this of how to delegate authority in different types of organizations. It turns out it depends on the type of an organization in terms of delegating authority. For example, if it's a company like Walmart, it pays to delegate a lot of authority to a private company like that because the markets are so different. You might sell Confederate flag t-shirts at a Walmart in Alabama, but not in Massachusetts, for example. And so the top management has to delegate a lot of authority to the local managers. There are other types of corporations where they can be more autocratic, where they don't have this problem of worrying about the local market being different in every county, something like that. Let's see, there's a few more questions here. What are the limits to bureaucratic growth? Do taxes go to 100%? I hope not, or does the government collapse? Well, the limits to the growth of government are as much as the public will tolerate in terms of taxes. But as we learned last week, though, what we have in the U.S. is something like 47% of all the adults pay no income tax. They pay other taxes, which are relatively smaller, but they don't pay the income tax. And so in their view, taxes can never be too high because they're not paying them. But of course, it will take a revolt on the part of the 53% who are paying income taxes against this. And government usually is smart enough to know that they don't want to instigate a revolt. They don't want to instigate a secession. And so their goal is to just pluck as many feathers from the taxpaying chicken as they can without causing the chicken to become too hysterical and go out and organize a riot among all the chickens. And so that's the way I think governments look at us. And that's one of the critiques that the Austrians had of supply-side economics in the 1980s, for example, was it was taken as a given that it would be a virtue to maximize government tax revenue. There was a famous Laffer curve that showed that if you tax people too high, they will not work as hard, they might take longer vacations, they might cheat on their taxes more, and so forth. And so drop their tax rates, okay, they'll work more, they'll save more, they'll invest more, they'll cheat less on their taxes, and the government will take in more revenue. And so they had this bliss point of maximum tax revenue in the literature on supply-side economics, and that assumes that it is necessarily a good thing for government to be bigger than it is now, because by giving it more money. The Austrians always challenged that assumption because it was sort of a normative assumption being snuck in under the guise of a positive economic theory, of an economic theory that was just analysis and was not making a value judgment. But it was very implicitly, if not explicitly, making the value judgment that it's a good thing for government to have more of our money. And so let's cut the tax rate and do that. And so you know, there is no rule for the limit of what taxes can go up to. But although it does seem to be, if you look at history, in the 1980 election, the top marginal tax rate in the United States was 70%, and if you had about $200,000 of family income, you were up in around that range, the 70% range, and that was the limit, at least at that level, at that period of time in the U.S. Scott asks, do you see the recent expansion of executive orders as alienating or consolidating force of existing government bureaucracies or another driver for government expansion? Well, probably both. I don't think so-called executive orders and the appointment of czars is a way of expanding, creating new government bureaucracies and expanding the reach of existing ones by allowing the executive branch to empower itself over the congressional branch. That, by the way, that sort of thing is one of the reasons why people like Ron Paul have criticized executive orders forever, you know, for as long as he's been in Congress, because we have had this move in the direction of greater and greater power given to the executive branch of government and less at the congressional level. And of course, both of them have increased their powers. But at least, the Congress members have to face re-election every 2 years and can be catch some heat, catch some flack over what they're doing. So with executive orders, it's a dictatorial power of the president who can be there for 8 years. Let's see. John asks, what do you tell people who defend the Environmental Protection Agency as a reason for government legitimacy? Well, the EPA, what do they spend? A couple $100 billion a year? How could you defend all of that? Every single bit? Every single penny they spend? People don't understand that there are other ways of protecting the environment. The common law was used to punish polluters for generations. The EPA did not exist prior to 1972, and that does not mean we had no environmental protection. You could not willy-nilly go and ruin somebody's property without facing the consequences of that. And so Rothbard wrote an article, long article on this general topic. I think it's called Law, Property Rights, and Air Pollution. And it's on the web, it's on MeToo.org, and it's probably on LouRockwell.com somewhere as well. But Law, that's the title of it. And so it explains sort of the Rothbardian view of this question. But, people have to get specific. The EPA has made a lot of gaffes and mistakes, too. So you can't just call something the Environmental Protection Agency. That's like saying, calling something the Life Protection Agency. How could you be opposed to that? It protects life against death. Case closed. And so you have to be more specific. People who say things like that, I think, usually don't know what they're talking about. There's the Rothbard article. We'll go to the chat area here and see if there's any chatting going on. It's different. Let's see, John says, would not term limits simply accelerate the rate at which a governmental administrator takes his spoils? That's a possibility. If you know you're only going to be there for 6 years, in other words, you might work 18 hours a day passing laws, passing out favors to defense contractors and other big corporations who you hope to work for in year seven. But still, that's only 6 years of that. And people are all different. At the same time, you have other people who know that they would have to be living under these laws for the rest of their lives, them and their children and grandchildren. Let's see, David asks about a psychological theory that you can help understand why leftists don't seem to know anything about bureaucracy. Yeah. Well, that's why they're leftists, I suppose. I mean, you know, this is sort of a chicken and the egg question. You know, I mentioned my old professor, James Buchanan, who said it's hard to be a socialist if you understand the economics of bureaucracy. And so that's one of the reasons why you are a socialist or a leftist, is you don't understand these things. The same is true, I think, of government regulation in general. Leftists tend to assume that government regulators walk around with angels' halos over their heads and will discipline the big bad corporations for the benefit of society. But of course, the reality is that government regulation is almost always used, government regulation of industry is almost used for the benefit of the industry being regulated. It's called the capture theory of regulation in the economics literature, and there's a lot of history behind it too. There's a whole book written on it, that's a classic, called The Triumph of Conservatism by Gabriel Kolko. It's called K-O-L-K-O. And our friend Butler Schaefer has also written an updated version of that type of book. It's called, the title of Schaefer's book is In Restraint of Trade, In Restraint of Trade by Butler Schaefer. And it's about how in the late 19th, early 20th century, big corporations in America were all in favor of government regulation because they knew that they could control the regulators. They intended to control the regulators, and they did. They succeeded, and they used regulation for their benefit. For example, even if the regulation imposed costs on their business, they understood that it would probably impose disproportionate costs on smaller competitors. It would also create barriers to competition from would-be or potential competitors. And so that's how they supported government regulation of their own industries. But I'm not sure, I don't know of any psychological theory about it. See, Brendan Trainer, they blame deregulation by knowing what it was deregulated. That's true. And it's also true that Glass-Steagall had nothing to do with the crash of 08, but that's sort of the buzzword of ignorant leftists everywhere, whether they're MSNBC television show hosts or, you know, the guy in the neighborhood who you argue with. They tend to be like that. For example, some years ago, the Baltimore Sun, I was teaching at Loyola University, Maryland, Baltimore Sun had articles for a whole month, top of the front page, about the failures of deregulation of electricity in the state of Maryland. Failures of deregulation, day in, day out, for a month. And finally, I took a few moments away from the book I was working on, and I looked up, you know, just what did this deregulation law in Maryland say in the year 2000. And what it said was that the price of electricity will be regulated, not deregulated, regulated for the next 6 years at the price that existed in 1995. But we will allow competition in. Anyone who wants to compete with Baltimore Gas and Electric Monopoly can now compete. So they announced that the price will be price controlled at a price that a lower price that existed 5 years earlier. For the next 6 years, who's going to invest in Maryland? What power company would invest? And then the 6 years went by, and of course nobody invested in building a power plant in Maryland with that kind of crazy law, regulatory regime in place. And then when no one came in, the politician said, well, we tried deregulation, it didn't work. And that's sort of a game that is often played. It's never deregulation, it's usually just a different kind of regulation, and they call it deregulation. Because they can never call it anything else. They'll lose the debate if they point out that free markets might possibly work. Let's see what other questions we might have here. Julian says the defining characteristic of leftism is the obsession with equality. There's a lot of truth in that. Von Mises wrote about this, and so did Hayek. Hayek wrote in the Road to Serfdom that socialism originally meant government ownership of the means of production. But then by the time you get to the 1960s, it had come to mean income redistribution through the income tax system and a big welfare state. But in each instance, Hayek said, the ultimate goal was egalitarianism. And the vehicles changed. The vehicles to achieve, supposedly, to achieve equality or egalitarianism changed, but the goal never changed. The goal always was egalitarianism. And that's what Hayek wrote in The Road to Serfdom. And so that is true of all leftists. They don't care about educating themselves as a rule. What they do care about is being able to strut around and brag that they are more morally pure than you are. I live among them. I've lived among them for 30 years in the academic world. And so you have all these people in the academic world, the vast majority of them, who associated themselves with the same ideology that Joseph Stalin and Mao Zedong and Castro and all these vicious murderers associated with. And they strut around university campuses pretending to be like angels occupying the moral high road at every instance while denouncing the civil society and free markets and free enterprise. It really is bizarre, but that has been my experience of what their motivation is to be able to brag that they care more than you do. And of course, they don't really care about the poor so much. If they did, they'd be volunteering to help individual poor people. Actually, Paul Johnson, the historian Paul Johnson, wrote a book called Intellectuals, maybe 20 years ago, 20 or so. And the theme of the book is mostly leftist intellectuals. The theme of the book is that, he has a chapter on Karl Marx and all these famous leftists, and the theme is that these are all people who profess to love humanity, but they seem to hate and detest the individual humans all around them. So it's sort of a biography of how all these famous left-wing intellectuals just treated their spouses and their children and the people who worked for them just horribly. But they wrote books and articles about how great lovers of humanity they were. And so on this question that's been asked here, I would recommend Paul Johnson's book, Intellectuals, on that. Let's see, the military certainly is bureaucratic, and therefore just as inefficient as any other bureaucracy. David McLean is asking, what role do you think is played by desire to leave layers of insulation between consumers and the leaders of government? It's kind of a complicated issue. Politicians themselves don't want to deal with the taxpayers necessarily. But although they do have, in Congress, for example, they do have large staffs to do that, to deal with constituents. But at the same time, the only way to have a big, vast government is you have to delegate power to the bureaucracies. The politicians can't run all these bureaucracies. And so the bureaucrats are out there. And what often happens is the bureaucracies who administer the welfare state and the warfare state, they take the criticism. If the Social Security Administration is doing a lousy job of getting the checks out on time, the members of Congress will be inundated with letters and phone calls complaining about this. And so they will hold a hearing, and they'll bring the head of the Social Security Administration up there, and they'll ream them out. They'll point their fingers at him, and they'll yell and shout and for the cameras. And then when it's all over, they'll give him a budget increase. Because what he is doing is he is taking the heat that the politicians themselves should be taking as the ones responsible for the government. They're the ones elected to run this government, not the bureau. bureaucrats who have lifetime tenure, essentially, in jobs like that. And so that's part of the game that is played, is that the bureaucrats will take the heat for the politicians, and then it's not uncommon that after they have these hearings, it seems very bitter, you know, the head of the EPA or somebody will call in and made fun of, and they'll say things like, you know, to the head of the Department of Energy, if we put the Department of Energy in charge of the Mojave Desert, we would have a sand shortage, and everyone will laugh, and then he'll go home and he'll get a big budget increase for his agency as his reward for sitting there and taking all the abuse and deflecting the abuse from the politicians. There have been many articles written about this phenomenon in the public choice literature. So this is not just some new theory that I dreamed up yesterday or this evening. I've been reading about this for a couple of decades in the public choice literature. Let's see, Julian is asking about seasteading. I don't know anybody, I don't know of anybody who's really doing any research or writing about seasteading. There's a son of David Friedman has become sort of well known in some circles for this, getting very wealthy people to buy private islands. I guess that's what you're talking about, seasteading. And I would think that the Rothbardians among us would be very supportive of this whole thing of creating free societies based on private property. I mean, that's the theme of Herman Hoppe's book, Democracy, the God That Failed, is a comparison of a private property-based society with democracy. And so something like seasteading would be very much approved, I would think, but I don't think there's been much said or written about it that I know of. Okay, I'll go back to Q&A. I think that's what it was. I'll go back to the chat here for a minute. Yeah, do we have any other questions here? I'm running out of questions, I guess. We don't have to sit here all night. Let's see if I can find any. Yeah, Cam is doing a great job. He finds everything I mentioned here. Yeah, there's Intellectuals by Paul Johnson. There's also a book called Intellectual Morons, which is also very good, very entertaining. I forget the author's name, but Intellectual Morons. Okay, we'll make a few more passes here. Well, if we don't have any more questions, we can call it a night. One more attempt, see if anybody's here. Okay, so we seem to run out of gas, guys. I guess we'll call it a night then. And the next couple of weeks, we're going to get into the sort of the nitty-gritty of economics, pure Austrian economics as applied to government taxing and spending. And there really is a lot to it. You can read op-ed articles by Austrians and from here and there, but Rothbard's Power and Market book really does a good systematic job of explaining the economics of taxation and the economics of government spending. And so I thought if you want to study the Rothbardian analysis of the state, that has to be included, and that's what we'll be doing. So thanks again for participating. I hope you learned a few things tonight. And feel free to email me, and I'll keep those book suggestions coming. Have a good night.